This is Fresh Air. Race, identity, and the ambivalence of assimilation is the subject of a new collection of essays called Lure and Loathing. The editor is my guest, Gerald Early. He directs the African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. Early is ambivalent about his own assimilation. He grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Philadelphia. He recently moved to a predominantly white suburb of St. Louis with his wife and two daughters. The move has enabled his children to attend good public schools, but it's removed him from the black community. He's even ambivalent about his success as an African-American intellectual, because that, too, has removed him from the black community.
I think in particular, in my case, as an intellectual, it's very difficult to stay rooted or in the black community in many respects if you're an intellectual, because the structure in the country that supports intellectuals are largely foundations, universities, and so forth. They're mostly white, mm-hmm. and you're pulled out of the community if you want to live as an intellectual. And to live as an intellectual and to do what you do in dealing with discourse of ideas is as, I don't want to call it pampered, but in some ways as sheltered a life as being an athlete, a professional athlete. And it also requires a lot of monetary support. It takes a lot of money to support an intellectual full-time and just dealing with ideas. And most of the rewards, most of the perks are found in the white world. And so that's where you naturally gravitate to, because that's where all the rewards and perks are. So I think you feel a kind of a double tension as some kind of intellectual, that you really have been pulled away and you really have been lured away by the rewards that are there for you in the white world.
Well, I guess even locating to be at a university, it can pull you into a university that is predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's different in a way from, say, the show business world, where there seems to be a kind of really growing number of African Americans who are successful in music and movies and television.
Right. There's a number of black Americans in the academic world.
They're divided, though. They're kind of spread out around the
country.
You're
spread out. You know, you get together at conferences.
Uh-huh.
Gossip, which is what everybody else does when you go to a conference. You are spread out. Most of the time at the university where you are, there are only a couple. I mean, you know, they're not very many. You're a very small community. So, I mean, you're spending a good deal of your time interacting with whites. A lot, you know, and this, it becomes a very complicated problem. I mean, it's a problem with your work insofar as a very kind of mundane question that people thought, oh, well, this question can't possibly be relevant, but it still is. Who's your work for? I mean, is your work for whites or is your work for blacks? I mean, obviously, because I want a certain kind of standing where I work, I want a certain kind of standing in my profession, I want a certain kind of standing among my colleagues. I mean, in some ways, my work is written for them. I mean, it's written to be read by them, and it's written to be read by them in a way that they understand that I understand the discourse, I understand certain kinds of intellectual issues, that I am a part of their world. In as much as it's pitched toward them in that regard is how, in some ways, it's not being pitched toward ordinary black people. Because I'm not dealing day-to-day with ordinary black people, and my colleagues are not ordinary black people, and the esteem that I get is not whether ordinary black people like my work, it's whether the white intellectuals I'm around like my work. And this causes another kind of identity crisis insofar as who you are and why are you doing what you're doing.
The issue of identity is in some of your essays,
mm-hmm.
And in your new book, you write about your daughters growing up in the suburbs, and you say that they would bring home their friends, and their friends would usually be white, and it started to worry you a little bit. You started worrying about the price that they might pay later on for a white social life. What's the price that you thought they might pay?
Well, I thought they might be ostracized by other black kids. In some ways, they are, even now. They come home and tell me, yeah, the other black kids think we talk white. And we act white. And they're confused by that. They don't understand why the other black kids say that. And they don't understand it because their father is this famous professor of black studies. So why are they going around saying, your kids act white, you know? So they're kind of confused by that. But I was very afraid that they would be ostracized there in some of the ways that they're being ostracized now. And that they would kind of lose track, but even more important than that, that was a secondary concern, but they would kind of lose track of or not fully understand what I'm about insofar as dealing with African American studies, because it's something that doesn't mean anything to them. So they find what I do kind of, you know, being an African American studies kind of arcane in a way. I mean, it's, yeah, well, that's what my dad does. So it kind of worries me that they are very distanced from what I do.
My guest is Gerald Early. He directs the African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerald Early. He's edited a new collection of essays on race and identity called Lure and Loathing. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about your coming of age. You write that you grew up, you grew up in the 50s and 60s in Philadelphia, and you say you grew up in a family of black women. I believe your father died when you were 1 year old.
Yeah, that's correct.
So who lived in your house?
Well, I had two sisters and my mother, and a parade of, for a time, my great aunt lived with me in our house for a couple years. And the biggest influences, not only just living in this household of women, were my mother's sisters, and they were a much more dominant presence in my life than my mother's brothers. So I felt pretty much almost exclusively surrounded by women.
What impact did that have on you as a man? Or as a boy?
Well,
male.
I think it's interesting. I'm still trying to assess that. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to writing about my daughters, because I now find myself still in the house of women with my wife and my daughters. I'm still trying to assess that. I think in some ways, I think when I was younger, certainly when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I think I had a great resentment for it. I really felt in some ways I had been denied a certain kind of essential masculine knowledge that I needed to get on in this world. And I think that was one of the reasons why I was attracted to jazz and I was attracted to boxing, was because they were masculine worlds. I really, for a certain stage in my life, I was almost obsessed with them because they were masculine. I'm a little bit more balanced now in that regard, but I think that my reaching out to those particular spheres of creative activity in large measure had to do with the fact that they were areas dominated by men.
You say that your mother was driven by ought to and consumed by must. Did she instill in you a sense of discipline and responsibility?
Yeah, incredible work ethic. I mean, my mother probably would have made a very good Calvinist, I think. It was incredible work ethic. And, it's carried over. It has its good points and its bad points.
What are they?
Well, insofar as the good points go, I would say that I've turned out to be, so far, pretty prolific academic, so far as putting out books. I like to work. I like the work, and I like to work. And I like putting out books. I like writing, and I'm a pretty prolific writer. I think the bad thing is that I can be, I think it makes you obsessive. It makes you at times overly ambitious, makes you directed in certain ways that you shouldn't be, insofar as seeing what your work is about, seeing what the value of your work is.
You had a cousin who was shot in the head in a gang fight when he was a teenager. What was the impact on your family when that happened?
It was a pretty big impact. You know, to have somebody murdered in your family, I think, is a pretty big deal.
What year was this?
This was 1973. This is still when the gang problem, teenage gang problem in Philadelphia was real bad. And so, yeah, you know, my family was pretty... upset by it all. I think they were kind of, you know, they were distraught, distressed, and I think somewhat ashamed to have somebody die in that way. For me, it was the start of my writing career because at that time I was a student at the University of Pennsylvania. And the very first thing I ever wrote for print that was published was an op-ed piece for the Daily Pennsylvanian about my cousin's death and his funeral. And that really started my writing career. I didn't know I was going to be a writer or intend to, but I just felt I had to write about this. And it was so well received, I guess because it was pretty unusual thing to have in the Daily Pennsylvania, that I wound up being writing for the paper.
It was the University of Pennsylvania newspaper. What did you really want to say about your cousin's murder that, you know, drove you to write about it?
Oh, that I was afraid it would happen to me, or it could have happened to me, something like that. We were very close in age, about 4.5 years apart. And so I knew all about gangs. I knew all about what that was. And, you know, I think I was kind of amazed by it because I said, wow, that could have happened to me. I think that was what I wanted to get to people. I think I wanted to write it and to present to people, you know, this is a life as a kid, you know. I mean, he wasn't a great kid, but he wasn't a terrible kid. He was just a kid, you know, I mean, and he did kind of boyish and wayward sort of things. You shouldn't die for something like that.
One more question. You really don't like the overuse of the word positive. You say the word positive has become the most brutal cant word in Black American discourse. What don't you like about this use of the word positive?
I don't know what people mean by it. I don't know what's positive. I mean, most of the time people are talking about something positive. They're talking about something. They're talking about they want something that's banal. They're talking about they want something that's philistine. They're talking about they want something that's the most mediocre, second-rate kind of moralism. And that's not really what creating is all about. That's not really what aspiration is all about. That's not really what... that's not really, in the end, although Black people a lot of times say, that's not really what they want. They want people who are out there who are taking risk. That's what really pushes the group ahead. Not to have a whole bunch of platitudes and bromides thrown at you and, you know, being told, oh, yeah, you can make it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, that's cornball stuff. I mean, when I was in school, they were having kids come. They were having people come to the assemblies who were saying that the kids were snoring on that stuff. They didn't want to hear that junk. They want to hear about, oh, you can make it and all that sort of stuff. It's something else that reaches into the life of people. And it's something else you have to tell people if you want them to live by two rules, the rule of justice and the rule of mercy. And, you know, so that's why, you know, for me, positive is just another one of those terrible Philistine bourgeois inventions.
Gerald Early, thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gerald Early edited the new collection of essays, Lure and Loathing, essays on race, identity, and the ambivalence of assimilation. This is Fresh Air.